Two essays from The Religion of Art by Sangharakshita, published by Windhorse Publications in 1988, comprising the following essays: The Meaning of Buddhism and the Value of Art, The Religion of Art, recorded by Dharmachari Ratnadia. After Rilke. The poet is the world's interpreter, at least to his own self. He recreates in his own heart the things he contemplates, and brings them forth transformed from what they were into a beauty truth that cannot err, that cannot fade or die. Though dull ingrates may mock, no vile disparagement abates the benefits the poet's words confer. A tree is not a tree unless within the poet's all-transmuting mind it grows refined, reborn, by his own power redeemed into a truer life. The poet's kin are Memnon, Orpheus, Merlin. History shows the best but live what once the poet dreamed. The Meaning of Buddhism and the Value of Art. It was about a century ago that Schopenhauer, who more deeply than any other Western thinker was influenced by and imbued with the spirit of ancient Indian philosophy, ventured to predict that the Renaissance that would be brought about by the discovery in the 19th century of the treasures of Oriental literature would be incomparably more glorious than that which had been ushered in during the 15th and 16th centuries by the rediscovery of the classics of Greece and Rome. This bold prediction of the 19th century is being fulfilled, or at least beginning to be fulfilled, in the 20th. What was merely political and commercial contact between the nations of the East and the West has begun to deepen into cultural exchanges and interreligious fellowship. Throughout every Western land, men and women are now to be found, few in number indeed, but increasingly influential, who are convinced that now as ever, light comes from the East. Ex oriente lux. Of the rays into which that light, shooting through the spectrum of human understanding, is broken up, none confronts Occidental eyes with steadier radiance or shines forth with a more blindingly brilliant effulgence than the hitherto unknown splendour to which the West, startled into awareness of a whole new world of values, has given the name Buddhism. Yet often is that splendour dimmed by the opacity of the medium through which it is transmitted. Even today, when the Pali Text Society of London and other bodies, as well as distinguished scholars working independently in the field of Buddhist studies, have between them published a small library of Pali, Sanskrit, Chinese and Tibetan Buddhist texts and their translations, the writers of articles and compilers of popular handbooks on Buddhism, ignoring this mass of authentic material, are frequently found repeating the same old misunderstandings about Nirvana and other points of Buddhist doctrine. Such misunderstandings, when they are not due to ineradicable religious prejudice, such as still animates many Christian writers on non-Christian religions, may be traced to a misconception of the very nature of Buddhism. This misconception has its roots deep down in the history of Western thought. Briefly stated, it consists in regarding Buddhism as a system of philosophy in the modern academic sense. To the ancient Greeks and Romans, philosophy was not merely an opinion, but a passion. It meant not only loftier thinking, but nobler living. A philosopher was expected to leave his hair and beard untrimmed, to wear but one long, simple garment, to sleep on the bare ground, and to eat sparingly. With the eruption of Christianity into the Greco-Roman world, the old classic ideals of moderation, balance, and harmony were destroyed. Wisdom was replaced by faith, while for the harmless and helpful philosophic life was substituted one of aggressive good works, which included the conversion of the heathen by force if necessary, and the burning of heretics. Between faith and works, some kind of harmony was indeed sought to be maintained, but covering as these did only a small part of the scale of human potentialities, this harmony was not rich or full enough to be long sustained, and before many centuries had passed, the shrill note of faith first dominated and then drowned all others. The modern scientific attitude of mind developed in part as a protest against the unverifiable dogmas of medieval Christianity, and every advance in scientific knowledge was made in the teeth of determined ecclesiastical opposition. For the schoolman, no less than the scientist, was aware that the victory of science spelled the defeat of faith. With the abandonment of Christian doctrine came the tacit repudiation of the Christian way of life, and though individual thinkers continued to conform to Christian ethical standards, and even in some cases professed to accept the Christian revelation, Western thought came more and more under the influence of science, and developed with increasing freedom from religious preconceptions. The introduction of psychological and epistemological interests strengthened still further the theoretical and speculative tendencies in modern thought, and by the time Schopenhauer arose to challenge the academic and professorial conception of philosophy, despite artificial attempts at reconciliation, the divorce between religion and philosophy had been made absolute. A division between concrete living and abstract thinking continues to characterize modern Western culture. Philosophy is taught at universities as a purely theoretical subject. It does not demand from its votaries the adoption of a distinctive mode of life, neither does it have as a whole any bearing upon practical affairs. For the philosophic life, as it was understood by the Greeks and Romans in even their most degenerate days, the passionate pursuit of beauty, truth, and goodness, and the endeavour to reflect them in one's own life, has been substituted the detached and barren study of the history of philosophical opinions. When the star of Buddhism first rose above these icy academic horizons, its dependence on reason rather than faith, its freedom from credulity and superstition, not unnaturally caused it to be regarded as an ethico-philosophical system rather than as a religion in the Christian sense of the term. Owing to the congenitally abstract proclivities of Western thought, the close connection between the practical and the theoretical aspects of Buddhism was gradually ignored, and topics such as the nature of nirvana came to be discussed as though they had a simply theoretical import that could be determined by the exercise of the speculative reason. The fact that Buddhism is, above all, a way of life was forgotten. Most of the problems and many of the misunderstandings which have arisen in connection with Buddhism may be traced to this wrong habit of considering the significance of its profoundest teaching in complete dissociation from their pragmatic consequences in the actual Buddhist way of living. Owing to the introduction of a Western-style system of university education, such misunderstandings have taken root and are flourishing even here in the soil of India, despite the fact that in this country, even more decidedly than in Greece or Rome, philosophy was traditionally regarded as the theoretical side of religion, and religion as the practical side of philosophy. It therefore becomes necessary to stress the fact that Buddhism is not a system of abstract thought, and that it does not attempt to satisfy mere intellectual curiosity by giving a rationally coherent account of the universe. Buddhism is a way of life that leads to a spiritual experience, in fact, to a number of experiences. These experiences link up into a series that culminates in the supreme experience of nirvana. Since it is not only a certain kind of thinking, but also a special way of living, the Dharma of the Enlightened One cannot be adequately understood by the reading of books, even Buddhist books, but only by practicing it and making an effort to absorb its spirit into one's life. The teaching of Buddhist philosophy as part of a course of studies, the principal aim of which is to qualify the student for secular employment by professors who make no attempt to put it into practice in their own lives, is really an abuse of Buddhism that will do both teacher and pupil perhaps as much harm as good. Partly by way of a precaution against the danger of regarding Buddhism exclusively from the theoretical point of view, and partly because of the difficulty of giving briefly an adequate account of two such vast subjects as Buddhism and art, I propose to elucidate the meaning of Buddhism not by attempting to make a summary of its doctrines, but by endeavouring to present it in a more concrete and poetic manner. The Chinese have a proverb that one illustration is worth a thousand words. I shall seek to make clear the meaning of Buddhism, not with one illustration only, but with three. Metaphors, similes, parables, and other literary forms have long been among the most recognized vehicles of religious instruction, and owing to their semi-poetic character, they often make a deeper and more enduring impression on our hearts than more learned but more prosaic treatment of the same theme can do. The following parables, drawn from sources widely separate in time and place, may be considered as illustrating the meaning of Buddhism from what is the most deeply spiritual and at the same time the most truly practical standpoint from which it can be viewed. The first of these may be called the parable of the well frog and the ocean frog. So well known to the people of India is this instructive fable that its hero has passed into a proverb, and well frog, Kupa Manduka, is an expression often applied, not without a touch of humour, to persons of narrow intelligence and bigoted views. The story is given in the words of Swami Vivekananda, by whom it was related, not without effect, at a session of the World's Parliament of Religions held in Chicago on 15th of September 1893. A frog lived in a well. It had lived there for a long time. It was born there and brought up there, and yet was a little, small frog. Of course, the evolutionists were not there then to tell us whether the frog lost its eyes or not, but for our story's sake, we must take it for granted that it had its eyes, and that it every day cleansed the water of all the worms and bacilli that lived in it with an energy that would do credit to our modern bacteriologists. In this way, it went on and became a little sleek and fat. Well, one day another frog that lived in the sea came and fell into the well. "Where are you from?" "I'm from the sea." "The sea? How big is that?" "Is it as big as my well?" And he took a leap from one side of the well to the other. "My friend," said the frog of the sea, "how do you compare the sea with your little well?" Then the frog took another leap and asked, "Is your sea so big?" "What nonsense you speak, to compare the sea with your well." "Well then," said the frog in the well, "nothing could be bigger than my well. There can be nothing bigger than this. This fellow is a liar, so turn him out." The parable of the prisoners of the cave is as permanent a part of the cultural heritage of Europe as that of the well frog and the ocean frog is of the religious traditions of India. Unlike its popular Eastern parallel, it is not anonymous, but exhibits to a superlative degree that wonderful combination of truth and beauty, of philosophic insight and literary art, forever associated with the incomparable genius of Plato. Imagine a number of men living in an underground cavernous chamber, with an entrance open to the light, extending along the entire length of the cavern, in which they have been confined from their childhood with their legs and necks so shackled that they are obliged to sit still and look straight forwards because their chains render it impossible for them to turn their heads round. And imagine a bright fire burning some way off, above and behind them, and an elevated roadway passing between the fire and the prisoners, with a low wall built along it like the screens which conjurers put up in front of their audience and above which they exhibit their wonders. "I have it," Glaucon replied. Also figure to yourself a number of persons walking behind this wall and carrying with them statues of men and images of other animals wrought in wood and stone and all kinds of materials, together with various other articles which overtop the wall, and, as you might expect, let some of the passers-by be talking and others silent. You are describing a strange scene and strange prisoners. They resemble us, I replied. For let me ask you, in the first place, whether persons so confined could have seen anything of themselves or of each other beyond the shadows thrown by the fire upon the part of the cavern facing them. Certainly not. if you suppose them to have been compelled all their lifetime to keep their heads unmoved? And is not their knowledge of the things carried past them equally limited? Unquestionably it is. And if they were able to converse with one another, do you not think that they would be in the habit of giving names to the objects which they saw before them? Doubtless they would. Again, if their prison house returned an echo from the part facing them, whenever one of the passers-by opened his lips, to what, let me ask you, could they refer the voice, if not to the shadow which was passing? Unquestionably they would refer it to that. Then surely such persons would hold the shadows of those manufactured articles to be the only realities. Without a doubt they would. Now consider what would happen if the course of nature brought them a release from their fetters and a remedy for their foolishness in the following manner. Let us suppose that one of them has been released and compelled suddenly to stand up and turn his neck round and walk with open eyes towards the light. And let us suppose that he goes through all these actions with pain and that the dazzling splendour renders him incapable of discerning those objects of which he used formerly to see the shadows. What answer should you expect him to make if someone were to tell him that in those days he was watching foolish phantoms, but that now he is somewhat nearer to reality and is turned towards things more real and sees more correctly? Above all, if he were to point out to him the several objects that were passing by, and question him and compel him to answer what they are, should you not expect him to be puzzled and to regard his old visions as truer than the objects now forced upon his notice? Yes, much truer. And if he were further compelled to gaze at the light itself, would not his eyes, think you, be distressed? And would he not shrink and turn away to the things that he could see distinctly, and consider them to be really clearer than the things pointed out to him? Just so. And if someone were to drag him violently up the rough and steep ascent from the cavern, and refuse to let him go till he had drawn him out into the light of the sun, would he not, think you, be vexed and indignant at such treatment? And on reaching the light, would he not find his eyes so dazzled by the glare as to be incapable of making out so much as one of the objects which are now called true? Yes, he would find it so at first. Such is the tremendous myth which Plato puts into the mouth of Socrates at the beginning of the 7th book of the Republic. Our third and last parable carries us from Greece to India, from the house of Polymarchus in the Piraeus outside Athens to the Jetta Grove in Anartapindika's park near Sarvati, from the noise and excitement of the Thracian festival in the 5th century BCE back to the quarrels and disputations of recluses and brahmanas in the 6th. So serious had these quarrels and disputes at one time become that they attracted the attention of certain bhikkhus, who came to the Buddha and reported the matter to him. After condemning the behaviour of these sectarians in strong terms, the Buddha related the parable of the blind men and the elephant. This parable was subsequently included in the repertoire of Indian storytellers and appears frequently in popular religious literature. By a strange twist of interpretation, however, it is now quoted as an illustration of the belief that all religions are equally true. An examination of the Buddha's own words will reveal the fallaciousness of such an interpretation. Now, in former times, brethren, there was a Raja in this same Sarvati. Then, brethren, that Raja called to a certain man, saying, "Come thou, good fellow, go and gather together all the blind men that are in Sarvati." "Very good, your majesty," replied that man, and in obedience to the Raja gathered together all the blind men, took them with him to the Raja, and said, "Your majesty, all the blind men of Sarvati are now assembled." "Then, my good man, show these blind men an elephant." "Very good, your majesty," said the man, and did as he was told, saying, "O ye blind, such as this is an elephant." And to one he presented the head of the elephant, to another the ear, to another a tusk, the trunk, the foot, back, tail, and tuft of the tail, saying to each one that it was the elephant. Now, brethren, that man having presented the elephant to the blind men, came to the Raja and said, Your Majesty, the elephant has been presented to the blind men. Do what is your will. Thereupon, brethren, that Raja went up to the blind men and said to each, Have you studied the elephant? Yes, Your Majesty. Then tell me your conclusions about him. Thereupon, those who had been presented with the head answered, Your Majesty, an elephant is just like a pot. And those who had only observed the ear replied, Well, an elephant is just like a winnowing basket. Those who had been presented with the tusk said it was a ploughshare. Those who knew only the trunk said it was a plough. The body, said they, is a granary, the foot a pillar, the back a mortar, its tail a pestle, the tuft of the tail just a besom. Then they began to quarrel, shouting, Yes, it is. No, it isn't. An elephant is not that. Yes, it is like that. And so on till they came to fisticuffs about the matter. Then, brethren, that Raja was delighted with the scene. Just so are these sectarians, who are wanderers, blind, unseeing, knowing not the truth, but each maintaining that it is thus and thus. Whereupon the Exalted One on that occasion, seeing the gist of the matter, uttered this solemn saying, Oh, how they cling and wrangle, some who claim of Brahmin and recluse the honoured name. For quarrelling, each to his view they cling. Such folk see only one side of a thing. These three parables illustrate different aspects of one truth. Each of them contains two different characters, or sets of characters, one representing a wider, more illumined and more comprehensive state of consciousness, the other a state of mind comparatively narrow, unillumined and exclusive. In the first parable, the parochial outlook of the well-frog, who dwells within a limited range of consciousness, represented by the waters of the well, is sharply contrasted with the ampler vision of his visitor, the ocean-frog, who inhabits a realm of consciousness which is infinite. Between those who, in the parable of the prisoners of the cave, are still fettered and can perceive only shadows flitting across the rear wall of their prison, and the released prisoner, who has been dragged out of the cave and compelled to behold the light of day, a similar difference may be observed. The third parable contrasts the correct idea of an elephant possessed by a man of normal sight with the erroneous notions entertained by the blind, thus illustrating the enormous discrepancy between the all-embracing wisdom of the Buddha and the one-sided opinions of the sectarian teachers of his time. Thus we have, on the one hand, an infinite consciousness represented by the waters of the ocean, the light of day, and the eyesight of a healthy man, and on the other, a narrow state of consciousness illustrated by the waters of the well, the gloom of the cave, and the eyesight of the blind. This difference renders possible two movements in consciousness, a movement of expansion from a narrower to a wider state, and a diametrically opposite movement of contraction from a wider to a narrower state. Buddhism as a way of life, as a practicable scheme of spiritual development, is based on the first movement, the movement of expansion. It aims at lifting us out of the well and plunging us into the ocean, at leading us from the darkness of the cave into the glorious light of the sun, at healing us of our spiritual blindness and restoring to our eyes the divine vision that they have lost. Ethically speaking, this expansive movement in consciousness consists in a continual renunciation of the self, in a constant progression from egoism to selflessness. Though 25 centuries of history have led Buddhism into many new developments, particularly in the field of spiritual practice and meditational technique, the validity of such developments is to be tested by this criterion. If they lead to an expansion of consciousness, to an illumination of mind and purification of heart, to a higher degree of spiritual sharp-sightedness, to emancipation from the fetters of egoism, then they may be considered as the teaching of the Master himself.
The Buddha stands alone among the founders of religions in not merely permitting, but even demanding that instead of accepting his words on trust, we should believe them only after having verified their truth in our own spiritual experience, testing them, in his own expressive simile, as on the touchstone the goldsmith tests his gold. Our spatial metaphor may be elaborated, and the meaning of Buddhism rendered still more explicit, by pointing out that expansion takes place in two planes, the vertical and the horizontal. By an upward or downward movement of expansion in consciousness is meant a heightening or deepening, the two expressions come to much the same thing, of experience, an increase of insight or augmentation of understanding. By a movement of expansion outwards is meant a constant multiplication of our points of contact with the external world, a ceaseless enlargement and elaboration of that delicate network of sympathy and affection by which we are connected in a thousand ways, not only with all other human beings, but with every other form of life. To the upward and downward movement of expansion in consciousness, Buddhism gives the name wisdom, prajna. The movement of expansion outwards it terms compassion, karuna. We shall not greatly err if, from a strictly practical and spiritual point of view, we find in a life dedicated to the expansion of consciousness through the development of wisdom and compassion the ultimate meaning of Buddhism. Having made the meaning of Buddhism clear, at least for practical purposes, we must now investigate its relation to art. By art is not meant, as people so often suppose, merely the art of painting, but the sister arts of music and poetry, architecture and sculpture as well. That Buddhism is justly famous not only for the richness and beauty of its artistic flowerings in India, but also for the fertility and vigour of the seeds it scattered all over Asia, is a commonplace of the history of Oriental art that need not be repeated here. What we propose to trace, however, is not the relation between Buddhism and art on the historical level, but their connection on the immeasurably deeper levels of psychology and the spiritual life. We do not intend to trace the vicissitudes of Buddhist themes as the subject matter of art, or to give either a description or a critical account of Buddhist painting, sculpture, architecture, or literature, but simply to ascertain the nature of the inner connection, as two independent branches of human experience between Buddhism as Buddhism and art as art. For only then shall we be able to estimate the value of art from the spiritual point of view. Neither the relation of art to Buddhism nor its spiritual value can, however, be determined until we have first acquainted ourselves with the precise nature of the subject of our inquiry. The word art, like other general ideas, is a mere abstraction, and no more denotes an actually existing object than the words liberty, freedom, independence, and similar terms of which newspapers make such lavish use, denoting concrete things existing either in the world of facts or in the realm of ideas. There is no such thing as art. Only works of art exist. No investigation into the nature of art can be fruitful that does not begin and end with a consideration of the nature of concrete pictures and poems. Back to earth, then, we come from the cloudy heavens of abstraction and proceed to plant our feet firmly on the ground with an analysis of the individual artwork into its two component parts. These parts may be described, if a not too exact usage of scholastic terminology be permitted us, as substance and as form. By the substance of a work of art, we mean the degree of sensitiveness or sensibility, the state of consciousness, the kind of experience or realization which it expresses and communicates. Form, on the other hand, is the pleasurable pattern of sensations into which the rarefied thoughts and emotions of the artist condense and crystallize themselves, and through which they find embodiment and expression. A refinement of analysis may help to define the second part more clearly. Even as the work of art is divisible into substance and form, so is the form in turn susceptible of a further division into a sensuous content and an organization of that sensuous content by means of pattern and rhythm. Eye and ear being the most prominent of the organs of sense, it follows that sensations of colour and shape, really we should telescope the words and say colour shape, as the two things that are distinguishable are inseparable, and sensations of sound provide the artist with the raw material of his creation. Brooding upon the chaos of visual sensations, the spirit of the artist begets dove-like the cosmos of painting, sculpture and architecture. Spreading wings over the abyss of sound, it produces the universe of poetry and music. At the fiat of creative genius, the discordant atoms of sensation, in order to their stations, leap and obey not the power of music, but the power whence music itself derives its influence. Through their organization of visual sensations, by means of the harmonious arrangement of colours, shapes and surfaces, and of auditory sensations, by means of rhythm and melody, the painter, the sculptor and the architect on the one hand, and the poet and the musician on the other, make patterns that are beautiful and which produce pleasure. These pleasurable patterns of sensations, which compose the form of a work of art, are in turn arranged in such a way as to express the artist's feelings and sense of values, which make up what we have termed its substance. Without entering into the psychology of artistic creation, or attempting to investigate the nature of that mysterious urge by which his life is dominated and sometimes destroyed, it may be affirmed that, from the viewpoint of the artist, there is a movement from substance to form, from the feelings that arise so irresistibly within him, and the ultimate embodiment of those feelings in metal, wood and stone, in pigment, words and notes. This movement is creation. From the viewpoint of one who reads a poem, looks at a picture or listens to a song, there is a movement from form to substance, from patterns made of certain visual and auditory sensations, from patches of colour and snatches of sound, to participation in the experience they embody. This movement is one of enjoyment or appreciation. But whether, in respect of the creative and appreciative experience of a work of art, there takes place a movement from substance to form, or from form to substance, it is of far greater importance to our present inquiry that there exists, on both cases, that stretching of the mind, some distance beyond the limits of the understanding, which Herbert Reid has clearly recognised as the function in art, and which we have already discovered and described in the form of an expansion of consciousness as constituting the spiritual meaning of Buddhism. In the case of the artist, the stretching or expansion is the cause of which the work of art is the effect. In the case of the enjoyer or appreciator, we would use the less clumsy appellation critic if it had not acquired such an unsympathetic connotation. The stretching of the mind beyond the limits of understanding, or the expansion of consciousness beyond the boundaries of selfhood, is the effect whereof the work of art is the cause. As with the expansion of consciousness through Buddhism, so with expansion by means of art, the movement of expansion takes place in two directions, on two planes. In Buddhism, there is a movement of wisdom upwards or downwards, and a movement of compassion outwards. Corresponding to this, there is in art an intensification or heightening of sensibility, as well as an extension or widening of sympathy. Some forms of art have a tendency to expand our consciousness in one direction rather than in another, while others expand it in both. Lyric poetry, for instance, lifts our gross human emotions of love and anguish, hope and despair, to so high a pitch of intensity that earthly passions are refined into spiritual raptures, and our whole emotional being keyed to a higher and purer octave of feeling. Classical music, whether Eastern or Western, often produces the same kind of effect. Dramatic poetry, on the contrary, by introducing us to men and women of every imaginable age and country, with every conceivable variation of character and circumstances, by compelling us to watch with interest and concern the vicissitudes of their fortunes, by forcing us to weep with them in their day of sorrow, and rejoice with them in their hour of mirth, extends and enlarges the house of our sympathies by a thousand ramifications into the many mansions of other lives. Epic and narrative poetry generally stretch the mind in the same direction as the dramatic, and so on a lower level do the novel and the short story. Such a distribution of functions between the fine arts should not, however, be taken in too literal and exclusive a sense, or regarded as being of very great importance to our present inquiry. All that we now wish to insist upon is the fact that every genuine work of art enlarges the circle of our consciousness, and that in this enlargement of consciousness, the value of a work of art from the spiritual point of view consists. Just as there are two kinds of expansion of consciousness, so within each kind there are infinite degrees of expansion. Some works of art lift us, as it were, only a few inches above the ground, others transport us to the empyrean. This difference of degree, whereby we distinguish the palpitations of Tom Moore from the authentic thrill of Shelley, is due to a difference in the quality of their inspiration. It is one of the great merits of Sri Aurobindo's literary criticism that he so clearly distinguishes the different levels whence flow of poetic inspiration may descend. Without necessarily endorsing all the details of his stratification of existence, we can both recognise and make use of the truth enunciated in the following passage. As for the originating source of poetry, it may be anywhere, the subtle physical plane, the higher or lower vital itself, the dynamic or creative intelligence, the plane of dynamic vision, the psychic, the illumined mind, even, though this is the rarest, the overmind. To get the overmind inspiration through is so rare that there are only a few lines or short passages in all poetic literature that give at least some appearance or reflection of it. Coupling Sri Aurobindo's doctrine with our own discovery, we may say that the higher the source of artistic inspiration, the greater is the expansion of consciousness involved, and the higher the spiritual value of the work of art produced. Care should be taken, though, not to confuse the essentially spiritual function of art as art with the didacticism of conventionally religious art. To make the matter clearer, it will be convenient to summarise a classification which we have made elsewhere. From the dual viewpoint of subject matter and quality of inspiration, four categories of art can be distinguished. The first is neither religious in form nor spiritualizing in effect. Spawned as it is in the slimiest depths of our psychic nature, it not only fails to expand our consciousness, but pandering to our lust for sex and crime, thrusts us down into the hell of an even lower and narrower range of consciousness. In modern life, examples of this kind are legion, and specification would be almost invidious. Tabloid newspapers, pulp magazines, and the majority of popular films may be mentioned as the principal purveyors of this pseudo-artistic trash. The second category of art is that which is formally but not essentially religious. Such are the lithographed pictures of gods and saints and religious teachers, which one finds in the possession of devout people all over the world. Though religious in theme, they are either technically inept or executed in mechanical fashion, without feeling, and do not produce an expansion of consciousness so much as condition a devotional reflex. Thirdly, we have a type of art that is essentially, though not formally, religious. Chinese landscape painting springs at once to mind as the almost classic example of this category of art. Though devoid of any formally religious content, such paintings are in the deepest sense spiritual. The extraordinary sense of liberation and infinite expansion of consciousness that they produce in the spectator being sufficient proof of the tremendous height of inspiration whence, like a cataract that smokes upon the mountainside, they descend through brushes and black ink onto rolls of silk. The fourth and last of our categories includes works of art that are both formally and essentially religious. Enough has been said of the three previous categories to make clear, without need of further explanation, the nature of this one, the crown and flower of them all. The ancient Buddhist art of India and Ceylon, China and Japan, Tibet and Cambodia, may without reproach of partiality be allowed the honour of representing this supreme class. Though it is difficult, even impossible, to single out any one type of Buddhist art as being more typical of the whole group than others, it will no doubt be conceded that the sedent image of the Buddha in meditation is the most popular and widely known of all. Here the meaning of Buddhism and the value of art coalesce upon the lips of the Buddha into a smile that expresses what is, perhaps, the greatest expansion of consciousness that it is possible for the plastic arts to meditate. From how high a quality of inspiration the work of art issued, we hardly dare to guess. How tremendous an effect it can have upon the whole character may be understood from a story which we heard a few weeks ago from a French lady, a scholar in Sanskrit and poetess in her own language, now a Buddhist nun in India, who had received so deep an impression, a spiritual shock of such high voltage, from an image of this kind which she had seen in the Musée Guimet in Paris, that she resolved to consecrate her whole life to the study and practice of Buddhism, so as to experience for herself, to however small an extent, that liberation of consciousness, that wisdom and compassion, which shone through those stone features as though they had been transparent to a light within. An archaic torso of Apollo that the poet Rilke saw in a museum seems to have produced a similar transformation in his consciousness. But since he was a poet, the transformation was not so much reflected in his life as registered in his art. Not that he was unaware of the spiritual significance of deep aesthetic experience. He was perhaps more conscious of the inner relations between the experience of the saint and the experience of the artist than any modern poet. And this consciousness makes him, in an age when external contact between religion and art has been broken off, an artist whose work is of very special significance and value. If the first 13.5 lines of his sonnet, An Archaic Torso of Apollo, show how deep, how heartfelt was his experience of beauty, the concluding 1.5 lines, which mark an abrupt, almost a violent transition from the descriptive to the reflective mood, reveal how clearly he understood the ethical and spiritual demands of that experience, and how little afraid he was to meet and grapple with them. His meaning is unmistakable, as feeling abruptly deepens into insight, and he cries out, Here is no place that does not see you. You must change your life. This change of life, this transformation of character and attitude, constitutes not only the message of the Buddha image and of the archaic torso of Apollo, but, as we have tried to show, the essence and meaning of Buddhism and the real value of art as well. Buddhism and art both effect a two-dimensional expansion in consciousness, and the practical results that they achieve are of the same kind. However greatly such results may vary in degree, and however dissimilar may be the methods employed by Buddhism on the one hand and art on the other to bring them about. Buddhism effects an expansion of consciousness by acting directly on the understanding and the will. Art produces a change of life indirectly by appealing to our sense of beauty. Since man possesses an emotional as well as an intellectual and a volitional nature, and is capable of response to beauty no less than to truth and goodness, it is necessary for him to develop and expand simultaneously the emotional, intellectual, and volitional aspects of his personality. Buddhism and art, therefore, are both indispensable to a balanced spiritual life. Not that we intend to suggest an absolutely exclusive distribution of functions between them, allotting to Buddhism the sole responsibility for developing the mind, and to art the sole responsibility for developing the emotions. Every thought possesses emotional colouring, however obscure. Buddhism, though acting primarily on the intellect, certainly makes a powerful secondary appeal to the emotions, especially to the devotional feelings, which are developed as fully, though not so one-sidedly, in members of the Buddhist community as in people belonging to religions that appeal more to the heart than to the head, to faith rather than to reason. Art, though it operates on the imagination directly, does not fail to influence the understanding. In poetry especially, it is impossible to dissociate the emotional impact of a work of art from the framework of objective reference to which it is attached and which constitutes its meaning for the intellect. Whether the life of any particular person will be dominated more by interests pertaining to Buddhism or more by interests pertaining to art is a question that will be determined by the relative strength in him of reason and of emotion. We are concerned only to insist, first of all, that the meaning of Buddhism coincides with the value of art, and secondly, that the development of understanding and insight through the one, and of imagination and sensitiveness to beauty through the other, is for modern men and women, in whom the emotional life and the intellectual life are of almost equal vividness and vigour, not only a need, but almost a necessity. Despite the obviously spiritualizing influence of many great works of art, there may be found in different communities and religious bodies people who think that religion and art are mutually exclusive, and that one who takes his religious life seriously ought to have no more to do with art than with drinking, dancing, and gambling. Puritans of this brand believe that since art makes its appeal through the senses, through eye and ear, its content is necessarily sensual and even sexual. To their way of thinking, which is wholly incapable of visualizing the wider horizons into which a life of genuine spirituality may open, an artistic life is practically synonymous with a career of immorality. Whenever a reaction against Puritanism sets in, its supporters generally go to the other extreme and proclaim the doctrine of art for art's sake. The middle way between these two extreme views is indicated by Sri Aurobindo, who, in some published letters to his poet disciples, has advanced what appears to be a satisfactory solution of the problem. All four extracts given below have been taken from Section 8, dealing with poetic creation and yoga, and with utility of literature, etc., in sadhana, of the third series of his letters, to which those interested in the subject are referred for further information. He writes, 1. A literary man is one who loves literature and literary activities for their own separate sake. A yogi who writes is not a literary man, for he writes only what the inner will and word wants him to express. He is a channel and instrument of something greater than his own literary personality. 2. I have always told you that you ought not to stop your poetry and similar activities. It is a mistake to do so out of asceticism or tapasya. One can stop these things when they drop of themselves, because one is full of experience and so interested in one's inner life that one has no energy to spare for the rest. Even then, there is no rule for giving up, for there is no reason why poetry and the like should not be a part of sadhana. 3. It would be a mistake to silence the poetic flow on principle. The creative habit is a tonic to the vital and keeps it in a good condition. And the practice of sadhana needs a strong and widening vital for its support. There is not real incompatibility between the creative power and silence, for the real silence is something inward, and it does not, or at least need not, cease when a strong activity or expression rises to the surface. 4. The Vedic poets regarded the poetry as mantras. They were the vehicles of their own realizations for others. Anything that carries the word, the light in it, spoken or written, can light this fire within, open a sky, as it were, being the effective vision of which the word is the body. In all ages, spiritual seekers have expressed their aspirations or their experiences in poetry or inspired language, and it has helped them and others. Therefore, there is nothing absurd in my assigning to such poetry a spiritual or psychic value and effectiveness of a psychic or spiritual character. This firm and emphatic vindication of the spiritual function of poetry, and by implication of the arts in general, could hardly be bettered, and may be allowed to stand as an adequate reply to all the objections which Puritanism may urge against the creation and enjoyment of works of art. But one serious difficulty still remains to be faced. Granting that the inner relation between Buddhism and art is such as we have described, and that art is, or at least can be, as Sri Aurobindo maintains, a part of sadhana, are we justified in assuming that such a view of the matter is correct from the standpoint of orthodox Buddhism? Are we not guilty of misrepresenting the Buddhist doctrine of the value of art? Buddhist art is undoubtedly a glorious achievement from the artistic point of view, but can it be regarded as a strictly Buddhist achievement? Is it not rather a beautiful excrescence on the trunk of Buddhism, like the mistletoe on the oak or the orchid on the elm? Some Buddhists do, in fact, seem to be of this opinion. They believe that the art stimulates sexual desire, and that the Buddha, therefore, prohibited his bhikkhu's disciples from enjoying works of art. For them, this prohibition is implicit in the eighth precept, observed by all bhikkhus and by lay devotees on the Upasata days. Nacha gita vadita visukha dasana veramani sikapadam samadhiyami, which is generally translated as, I observe the precept of abstaining from dances, songs, instrumental music, and theatrical performances. This precept, they maintain, in effect excludes not only the enjoyment of the arts of singing, dancing, and music, but also of poetry and painting, sculpture and architecture, from all of which a true follower of the Buddha should hold himself rightly aloof. Buddhism is, in their opinion, puritanical in its attitude to art. An enlightened mind, which is free from even the slightest taint of desire, is by its very nature incapable of aesthetic enjoyment, for such enjoyment, they believe, is of a fundamentally sensuous and even sexual character. Whether Buddhism agrees with this puritanical evaluation of the nature and function of art, or whether its view of the relation between the spiritual life and the artistic life approximates to that which we have taken above, is a question which can be answered firstly by referring to Sri Aurobindo's teaching about the different levels, from the subtle physical to that of the overmind, whence artistic inspiration can originate, and secondly by an appeal to the personal example of the Buddha. From information available in the three baskets, Tipitaka, of canonical scriptures and in their commentaries, it is evident that the dancing, singing, instrumental music and theatrical performances of the eighth precept belong to the first of our four categories of art, that is to say, they were neither religious in form nor spiritualizing in effect. Like the songs, dances and orchestral music of the contemporary film, they originated from what Sri Aurobindo terms the subtle, physical and vital planes, and it may be contended that the Buddha required his disciples to abstain from such kinds of entertainment, not because they were art, but because they were not art of that deeper and more genuine kind which we have included in the third and fourth of our categories. The prohibitions of the eighth precept can no more be generalized into a total exclusion of all kinds of art from the purview of the spiritual life than, for example, a contemporary spiritual master's disapproval of cinema going could be construed as a condemnation of classical music or of poetry and painting. Sri Aurobindo, whose views on the spiritual function of art we have quoted so extensively, says of novel reading in sadhana, if novels touch the lower vital or raise it, they ought not to be read by the sadhaka. No contradiction is involved in prohibiting one kind of art to the spiritual aspirant and permitting him the other. Indeed, it is just what might have been expected. But even though, in imparting the eighth precept to his monastic disciples and lay devotees, the Buddha intended no more than a prohibition of the ancient Indian equivalent of dance music, what evidence is there, it may be demanded, that he regarded the appreciation of art, the enjoyment and creation of painting, poetry and music, as being compatible with the demands of the spiritual life?
If the records of his life and teaching contain even one reference to his appreciation of the beauties of art, it will be sufficient to prove that such appreciation is not impossible to the enlightened mind, and that, therefore, the content of art is compatible with the content of spirituality. We shall cite not merely one, but three such references. The first demonstrating his appreciation of music, the second his approval of poetry, and the third his sensitiveness to visual beauty. The Buddha's appreciation of music is recorded in the Sakka Panya Suttanta of the Digha Nikaya, the first of the five great divisions of the Sutta Pitaka, or Basket of Discourses. Sakka, king of the gods, wished to ask the Buddha certain questions, but seeing that he was absorbed in meditation, hesitated to approach him. He therefore sent in advance one of the Gandharvas, or celestial musicians of his court, whose skill in music and song is in Indian literature as famous, though not as fatal, as that of the sirens in the literature of the West. We quote the whole of this charming episode, which provides an introduction of great literary beauty to the more serious discussions between the Buddha and Sakka, which make up the bulk of this Suttanta. "Then," said Sakka, the king of the gods, to Five Crest, the Gandharva, "difficult of approach, dear Five Crest, are the Tathagatas, to one like me, when they are wrapped in the bliss of meditation, and for that purpose abiding in solitude. But if you are first to gain over the Exalted One by your music, then might I afterwards come up and visit him, the Arahant, the Buddha Supreme." "So be it, and good luck to you," consented Fivecrest. And taking his lyre, he went to the Indrasal tree cave. On coming there, he thought, "Thus far will the Exalted One be neither too far from me nor too near to me, and he will hear my voice." And he stood on one side and let his lyre be heard and recited these verses concerning the Awakened One and the Truth, the Arahants and Love. "Lady, thy father Timbaru I greet with honour due, O glory of the sun, in that he wrought a thing so nobly fair as thou, O fount divine of all my joy. Sweet as the breeze to one fordone with sweat, sweet as a cooling drink to one athirst, so dear art thou, O presence radiant, to me dear as to Arahants the truth. As medicine bringing ease to one that's sick, as food to starving man, so, lady, quench, as with cool waters, me who am all aflame. E'en as an elephant, fretted by hook, dashes unheeding curb and goad aside, so I, crazed by the beauty of thy form, know not the why and wherefore of my acts. By thee my heart is held in bonds, and all bent out of course, nor can I turn me back, no more than fish once he hath ta'en the bait. Within thine arm embrace me, lady, me with thy soft languid eyne embrace and hold, O nobly fair, this I entreat of thee. Scanty in sooth, O maid of waving locks, was my desire, but now it swelleth I, indefinitely great, e'en as the gifts made by the faithful to the Arahants. Whate'er of merit to such holy ones I've wrought, be thou, O altogether fair, be thou the fruit thereof to fall to me. Whate'er of other merit I have wrought in the wide world, O altogether fair, be thou the fruit thereof to fall to me. As the great Sakyan seer, through ecstasy rapt and intent and self-possessed, doth brood seeking ambrosia, even so do I pursue the quest of thee, O glory of the sun. As would that seer rejoice, were he to win ineffable enlightenment, so I with thee made one, O fairest, were in bliss. And if perchance a boon were granted me by Sakka, lord of 33 gods, 'tis thee I'd ask of him, lady, so strong my love. And for thy father, wisest maid, him as a sal tree freshly burgeoning, I worship for such peerless offspring green. When Five Crest had finished, the exalted one said to him, The sound of your strings, Five Crest, so harmonizes with that of your song, and the sound of your voice with that of the strings, that your lyre does not too much colour your song, nor your song too much colour your play. Where, Five Crest, did you learn these verses concerning the awakened one and the truth, the arahants and love? The exalted one, Lord, was once staying at Uruvela on the bank of the Naranjara River, at the foot of the goatherd's banyan tree, before he attained to enlightenment. Now at that time, Lord, the lady called Bada, in appearance as Sunshine, daughter of Timbaru, king of the Gandharvas, was beloved by me. But that lady, Lord, was in love with another, Sikadi, son of Matali, the charioteer. And since I could not get the lady by any method whatever, I took my lyre of yellow baluva wood, and going to the abode of Timbaru, king of the Gandharvas, I played my lyre and recited these verses concerning the awakened one and the truth, the arahants and love. And when I had finished, Lord, the lady Suryavakasa said to me, That blessed one, sir, I have not seen face to face, and yet I heard of him when I went to dance at the Sudama Hall of the 33 Gods. Since you extol the Blessed One, let there be a meeting between thee and me today. So, Lord, I met that lady, not on that day, but afterwards. At the end of the Sutanta Saka, the King of the Gods, having obtained from the Buddha satisfactory answers to all his questions, and having gained the stainless, spotless eye for the truth, in return for the services he had rendered, made Five Crest king of the Gandharvas, and bestowed upon him the hand of the lady Suryavakasa. This idyllic episode reveals not only the Buddha's appreciation of music, but also his tender humanity. One can almost imagine the smile of amusement with which the passionless one listened to the woes of the lovelorn Gandharva. The Buddha's appreciation of poetry has been recorded in the Vangisa Samyutta, the 8th section of the Samyutta Nikaya, Book of the Kindred Sayings. Vangisa was one of the most gifted of the Buddha's disciples, and each of the group of 12 suttas bearing his name contains a piece of poetry, together with a prose introduction narrating the circumstances that led to its composition. The poetry is included, without the prose, in the Theragata, or Songs of the Elder Bhikkhus, one of the books of the Kudaka Nikaya, which also contains verses by Vangisa from the Sutta Nipata not found in the Samyutta. The first 4 poems are verses of self-condemnation, of repentance for lust and pride, and express the poet's determination to attain to the extinction of all mental impurities in the passionless peace of nirvana. The following 7 suttas, most of which contain verses of great literary beauty, reveal the Buddha, and in one case Sariputta also, as encouraging Vangisa in the exercise of his poetic gift. Sutta 11 is short and poetic enough to be quoted in full as a typical example of the Buddha's attitude. The exalted one was once staying at Kampa, on the shore of the lotus pool at Gagara. And with him was a great company of brethren, even 500, and 700 lay adherents, and 700 lay women adherents, and some thousands of devas. Among them all, of a truth, the exalted one shone exceedingly in beauty and in glory. Then the venerable Vangisa arose from his seat, and draped his outer robe over one shoulder, bent his clasped hands, saluting towards the exalted one, and said, It is revealed to me, exalted one. It is revealed to me, blessed one. And the exalted one said, Be it revealed to thee, Vangisa. Then the venerable Vangisa extolled the exalted one, and in his presence, with appropriate verses. As when the clouds have drifted from the sky, the moon shines as a sun immaculate, so thou, Angirasa, great seer,
yet more dost gloriously the world illuminate.
In each of the other six suttas also, Van Giesa is encouraged to make use of his by no means inconsiderable poetic talents, and he improvises verses on speech that is well spoken, in praise of Sariputta, on occasion of the Pavarana ceremony, on the preaching of the Buddha, on Anasi Kondana's homage to the Master, and in recognition of the psychic power of Moggallana. Sutta 8 contains not only the permission to improvise, for which Van Giesa asks, and the Buddha invariably grants, but a few additional lines of dialogue not found in the other suttas, which prove how emphatic was the Blessed One's approval, and how unambiguous his encouragement of the type of poetry in which Van Giesa excelled. After Van Giesa, in a burst of enthusiasm, had compared the Buddha preaching the Dharma to his disciples to a great storm cloud pouring down plenteous rain upon the earth, and had concluded with a stanza in adoration of the Master, the Exalted One said, "Say now, Van Giesa, were these verses thought out by thee beforehand, or have they been revealed to thee just on the spot?" "Nay, Lord, these verses were not thought out by me beforehand. They were revealed to me just on the spot." "Wherefore, Van Giesa, let yet more verses not thought out beforehand be revealed to thee just on the spot." "So be it, Lord," replied Van Giesa, and in additional verses not thought out beforehand, he extolled the Exalted One. "O Mara's devious ways, faring triumphant, thou breakest up the fallows of our hearts. Behold him from all bondage our deliverer, himself full fraught the harvest he imparts. Yea, thou hast shown a way by many methods for crossing o'er the torrent safe to land, and that ambrosial thus manifested, norm-seers inexpugnable we stand. Light-bringer, he hath pierced beyond, beholding past all those stations where we end our flight, the topmost height knowing and realizing, he showeth us that vantage point of sight. Lo, now in truth so well revealed, for trifling what place is there for those who learn his law? Hence zealously within that master's system, train ye alway, and while ye train, adore." In the 6th century BCE, Indian painting had not yet embarked upon the career which was to culminate in the frescoes that glorify the caves of Ajanta, and we are therefore precluded from referring to any instance of the Buddha's appreciation of visual art in its more refined and developed forms. At least one example, however, can be cited of his sensitiveness to the beauty of the human body in motion, and to the harmonious effect of contrasted colours. And inasmuch as form and colour constitute the two basic elements of the visual arts, the Buddha's appreciation of them as they occur in nature may be understood as being in principle not different from the appreciation of the arts of painting and sculpture. Our example is taken from the Mahaparinirvana Suttanta of the Digha Nikaya, which is admitted to contain some of the oldest and most authentic material found in the Pali canon. The passage throws an interesting sidelight on contemporary sartorial fashions. "Now the Lichavis of Vesali heard that the Exalted One had arrived in Vesali and was staying at Anapabali's grove. And ordering a number of state carriages to be made ready, they each mounted one of them and went forth with their train from Vesali. Some of them were dark in colour and wearing dark clothes and ornaments. Some of them were fair in colour and wearing light colours and ornaments. Some of them were red, ruddy in colour and wearing red clothes and ornaments. Some of them were white, pale in colour and wearing white clothes and ornaments. When the Exalted One saw the Lichavis approaching in the distance, he addressed the brethren and said, 'O brethren, let those of the brethren who have never seen the Tavatimsa gods gaze upon this company of the Lichavis. Behold this company of the Lichavis, compare this company of the Lichavis, for they are even as a company of Tavatimsa gods.'" The simile implied by this passage is not present by an accident. Aesthetic emotion naturally tends to express itself on the literary side in figures of speech of various kinds.
that the Buddha, moved by the beauty of the richly dressed and ornamented lichavis, should have compared them to a company of celestial beings, is not attributable to any desire on his part for the edification of the brethren, but rather to the spontaneous outburst of his aesthetic emotions. In addition to these specific instances of the Buddha's own appreciation of art, it is possible to adduce in support of our contention that, even from the orthodox Buddhist point of view, the content of art is not incompatible with the content of spirituality, and that the religious life does not exclude artistic interests, a number of general considerations. Since the Buddha's teachings were preserved not by means of pictures or musical notation, but in words that were subsequently written down in books as works of literature, it is inevitable that these considerations should be of a predominantly literary character. One of the first things that arrests our attention when we take up any canonical Pali book is that a great deal of it is in verse. Some books, indeed, such as the Dhammapada and the Sutta Nipata, consist either entirely of verses or contain only a small intermixture of prose passages. The Tera and Teri Gathas, or psalms of the elder brethren and elder sisters, many of them extemporized after their composer's enlightenment, are perhaps the most outstanding examples of the former class. Besides being spiritual documents of rare value, they contain gems of spiritual poetry of the highest water. And Mrs. Rhys-Davids, in the introduction to her pioneer work of translation, Psalms of the Early Buddhists, One, the Brethren, has not hesitated to compare the most poetically gifted of the Teras with Keats and Shelley. Though felicity of verbal music is the basis of her comparison, it is by no means the only point of similarity between the verses of the Indian and the English poets. Like the Romantics, the Teras had an eye for the beauties of nature, and Mrs. Rhys-Davids goes as far to suggest, the idea might shock an orthodox Buddhist, that they sought the solitude of the forests as much for aesthetic as for spiritual reasons. It is even possible to claim the Buddha himself for a poet. The Pali scriptures contain thousands of verses which are traditionally believed to have fallen from the lips of the master. One whole book, the Udana, consists of a number of verses, each followed by a narrative in prose, of the circumstances which led to its composition, which the Buddha breathed out, the literal meaning of the title word, in moments of intense emotional pressure. The bulk of the sacred canon, though prose in form, is frequently poetical in spirit. Enriched with vivid and appropriate metaphors, similes, parables, and other figures of speech, which delight the imagination as well as illumine the understanding, the discourses of the Buddha often glow with a subdued and serene loveliness which makes his words as beautiful as they are true. The undeniable fact that the Buddha and his enlightened disciples could appreciate and enjoy the beauty of nature and of art, and that they could even add to the sum of that beauty by their own aesthetic activities, is, we believe, sufficient proof of our contention that religion and art both are manifestations of the same movement of self-transcendence, and that the genuine devotee and the true artist travel along ultimately converging paths. For the benefit of those who, though knowing that the passages we have cited from the scriptures are authentic, may doubt whether the interpretation we have given of them is correct, we shall set the final seal of orthodoxy upon our views by quoting a modern writer of unquestionable reliability, whose expositions of Buddhist doctrine are based on the strictest commentorial tradition. Referring to mental culture, Bhavana, the second of the three stages into which, according to one scheme, the path to nirvana is divided, Dr. C. L. A. da Silva says, "The volitions arising in the processes of thought during the time of learning the Dharma Vinaya, the doctrine, or any arts, sciences, and so on, too, are included under the heading of mental culture or bhavana." The inseparability of Buddhism and art arises out of the nature of our psychic life.
Though will, intelligence, and emotion may be distinguished in thought from one another, and spoken of as if they were separate faculties, in reality they can no more be divided in this way than can the shifting green and gold and purple that shimmer on a pigeon's neck. Consequently, the spiritual development of man must either take place on all levels of his being, in all aspects of his personality, practical as well as theoretical, emotional no less than intellectual, or not at all. One part of him cannot soar eagle-like into the empyrean, while another wallows pig-like in the mire. For ultimately there are no parts, and it is not piecemeal, but as a whole, that the life of man must either rise or fall in the scale of values. Spiritual practice, taking the expression in the widest sense, as whatever conduces to the expansion of consciousness, to self-transcendence, must develop to the full all the faculties with which human personality is endowed. And it must develop them not one-sidedly, but in a manner so harmonious that, at every stage of the spiritual ascent, they balance each other and approximate as nearly as possible to that condition of perfect equilibrium which will be theirs when consciousness has been expanded to its farthest limits, the ego utterly transcended. Modern man, by which we mean modern Western man and his imitators in Eastern countries, suffers from a dissociation of intellect and emotion so chronic that it has almost paralyzed his will for spiritual good. A kind of psychological elephantiasis has made him monstrous with an overdeveloped intellect and underdeveloped emotions. By this we do not mean that he is emotionally inactive, far from it, but that his emotional life, if so crudely spatial a metaphor may be pardoned, is on a much lower level than his intellectual life. His emotions are not non-existent, but undeveloped. Intellectually mature, he remains in feeling a child. The scientist, whose intellectual curiosity is not satisfied until he has numbered all the stars of the Milky Way, or measured as though with a rod the immensities of the heaven, seems to find full satisfaction for the affective side of his nature in the emotional muck heaps of the popular film, in detective fiction, or in an occasional sexual embrace. One of the results of this rupture between the intellectual and the emotional life is that even the intellect is not developed with reference to a scale of values external to itself, but only with reference to the degree of its own internal complication. The need of modern man is, we conclude, for a development in his emotional nature, which will render spiritually fruitful the intellectual development which has already taken place, and which will, by restoring the long-lost equilibrium between his faculties, render possible for the whole personality that movement of ascent, of expansion, of consciousness, and self-transcendence, the secret of which seems to have been lost to Western civilizations for so many centuries. One of the normal instruments of emotional development in the past was religious devotion. But religion in the dogmatic Western Christian sense of the term has become so repugnant to modern man that the use of this instrument is often impossible. The discovery of some other means of refining his emotional life, therefore, becomes an imperative necessity. Such a method, we believe, may be found in the creation and enjoyment of works of art, provided that these activities are carried on with a vivid awareness of their spiritual function and significance. The desiderative nature of man clamours for satisfaction, and its demands cannot be ignored. If an outlet is not found for it on a higher level, then it will force one for itself on a lower. Sublimation of desire is, perhaps, the central problem of ethics, for sublimated desire is the dynamo that generates the energy whereby the machinery of the whole spiritual life is kept in motion. Art is important and valuable, in some cases even necessary, to the spiritual life, because it provides a channel for the emotional energies, leading them from lower to ever higher levels of expression. At each level, the emotions galvanize the whole personality into activity. On the lower levels, into the innumerable activities whereby the ordinary man seeks to gratify his petty lusts and vanities. On the higher, as compassion, into the infinitely diverse expedients whereby Buddhas and Bodhisattvas seek to deliver mankind. For the sublimation of the emotions, two things are necessary: a consciously imposed check on the lower and a consciously opened outlet on the higher levels of experience. The first is generally provided for the individual by the society in which he lives through a system of taboos. Of these taboos, the most important are those which, by checking the expression of the two primary emotions of love and hate, regulate the creative and destructive functions of emotion. Unfortunately, modern society often imposes the checks on one level without opening the outlets on the other. The individual, lacking any view of life which enables him to understand the possibility of attaining to a higher and wider kind of experience, is irritated by the constant imposition of what appear to him quite arbitrary checks to his natural impulses, and ultimately he rebels against them. Psychological facts such as these help to explain a great deal of student indiscipline, juvenile delinquency, and other destructive manifestations of emotions that have been denied creative expression, and point to the necessity of giving a more prominent place in the educational curriculum to interests and activities by which the emotions are refined and sublimated. If the kind of education we receive should be determined, to some extent at least, by the kind of persons we are, and if emotion is agreed to be no less a component of human nature than reason, then no denial of the necessity of finding a place for art in the scheme of education can logically be made. Inasmuch as the ideals governing the educational system of a given society are generated by the application, within the narrower field of educational theory and practice, of ideals that govern not only that society, but the whole civilization to which it belongs, it is to be expected that the absence of art today from our schools and colleges is but the reflection of a death of beauty in modern life. Since the Industrial Revolution, the cities in which the countries of the West have gradually concentrated their populations have been dominated by an ever-increasing ugliness. Through political and commercial channels, the products of this ugliness have flooded not only the Western but the Eastern world as well. And even now, high on the shores of traditional civilizations like those of India, Ceylon, and Burma, the retreating tide of imperialism has left a noisome deposit of ugliness, which, putrefying in the tropic sun, continues to infect the lives of most Oriental peoples. Modern man, whether of the East or of the West, is suffering from starvation of beauty, and until he again receives and assimilates that divine pabulum, there is little hope of his being restored to spiritual health. Before World War II, the moral rearmament movement was launched in England. The inauguration on a global scale of a movement for aesthetic rearmament, the launching of a worldwide battle for beauty, is today no less necessary. Until an outlet for the emotions of man is found on those higher levels of experience to which art and religion alike give access, they will continue on the lower their turbulent and destructive career. Like the two wings of a bird, reason and emotion are both indispensable to the spiritual flights of man. Higher still and higher, from the earth thou springest like a cloud of fire. The deep blue thou wingest, and singing still dost soar, and soaring ever singest. The spiritual aspirant is like Shelley's skylark. While his understanding soars, his emotions sing. It is in this singing and soaring, in the simultaneous expansion of the understanding and the emotions, that we find the meaning of Buddhism and the value of art, and, in fact, the secret of spiritual life. This concludes the essay, The Meaning of Buddhism and the Value of Art.